This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station. Community amplified.
Immigrants and refugees are not separate from the American story. They are central to it. And at this 250th anniversary, it is up to all of us to decide whether that story defines America's future or if it only remains part of our past.
I'm News Director Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's News Roundup. Today, what it means to be an American 250 years after the nation declared independence. We'll tell you where in Maryland to find two copies of the Declaration of Independence and more about one woman who printed it. Then, later in the show, we celebrate the Baltimore neighborhood of Cherry Hill.
Some people said people would never attend a festival in Cherry Hill. Every year, thousands now gather in Cherry Hill.
That's all coming up next. And good afternoon. You're listening to WYPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, news director of the award-winning WYPR Newsroom. Tomorrow, the United States celebrates its 250th anniversary, 250 years since the signing of the Declaration of Independence. We have a conversation coming up about some of those signatures and a woman who printed the Declaration. Plus, who from Maryland fought for the Revolution? Well, it may not be who you think it was. New research is uncovering all the details of 400 Maryland servicemen who fought in the American Revolution, and we'll talk about Black Marylanders who were part of the Continental Army and those who fought alongside British forces. But now, 250 years later, what does it mean to be an American? The U.S. Supreme Court recently issued two opinions that had the potential to change that definition. Birthright citizenship, the right to U.S. citizenship for those born on U.S. soil. The court narrowly upheld that this week. President Trump is now imploring the Republican-led Congress to end that right. Prior to that, the Supreme Court issued another ruling last month to leave temporary protected status for refugees in the hands of the president. This could mean deportation for hundreds of thousands of refugees here in the United States right now. To talk about it with us, we have Krish O'Mara Vignaraja. She's the president and CEO of Global Refuge. Welcome, Krish. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So a day ahead of Independence Day, President Trump's mass deportation plan continues. And last week, the U.S. Supreme Court voted 6-3 to help with that by giving the president the power to end temporary protected status, or TPS, effectively sending home hundreds of thousands of Haitian and Syrian refugees who came to this country for safety from war and gang violence. Many of those now have families here who are U.S. citizens. Krish, tell us what TPS is and how the Supreme Court decision changed it.
So TPS is temporary protected status. It is a law that Congress put in place in order to keep people from being returned to danger. And as part of that designation, there's a built-in process that the government has to follow. And so in the case, the objection was that the administration skipped the process, not that it lacked the power.
One of the reasons we got in touch with you is because you work with refugees around the country, but you are based in Maryland, and we wanted to talk to you about that. So from the people you're talking with after this ruling, what are they telling you?
Well, I think this ruling is obviously a legal decision, but for hundreds of thousands of families, this is profoundly personal and deeply devastating. As you said, at Global Refuge, we work with families who've survived things that most of us will never, ever come close to experiencing. Gang violence, civil war, the collapse of everything familiar. And I've sat across from families, and what strikes me every time is how little they're asking for. All they want is the chance to keep doing what they've already been doing here in the United States, working, raising their kids, contributing to their communities. And so the immediate question that we're hearing from families, children here in Maryland, all across the country, is what comes next? And I think that is what worries me.
We'll get to what comes next in a little bit. But first, this decision from the Supreme Court, again, that came out last week on a 6-3 ideological line. There was a separate constitutional claim by Haitians claiming that a decision to force them from the U.S. was based on racial prejudice. Judge Alito's response acknowledged the language of this administration, saying, quote, political discourse by prominent public figures is increasingly couched in terms that would have scandalized the public just a short time ago. But in his words also, quote, insufficient to show the termination of Haiti's TPS designations was based on the race of Haitian people. Do you agree? Do you see this argument being made by the Haitian community? What have you seen?
Well, it's incredibly difficult when you hear the kind of offensive language that was used to describe Haiti. The accusation altogether unfounded that Haitians were eating cats and dogs. It certainly raised a legitimate equal protection claim. And unfortunately, the majority concluded that it was unlikely to succeed because the government, they said, offered a race-neutral explanation, which was that the administration opposes TPS as a program. It is true that this administration has been clear that they don't like TPS. They've attacked it when it's come to 13 of the 17 countries that have it. But that ruling narrows the pathway for holding administrations accountable when policy decisions disproportionately harm and really target Black and brown immigrants.
Now, it's worth mentioning there is a sizable Haitian community in Maryland out in Salisbury on the Eastern Shore. They had a big role in sustaining the poultry industry there. What do you know about what is happening for them?
It is important to understand the local impact. We have 33,000 TPS holders in our state. That's the 10th largest in the country. And as you said, Haitian immigrants are an essential part of the Eastern Shore's economy. For decades, Haitian workers have helped sustain the Delmarva poultry industry, one of the region's largest economic engines. They fill critical jobs in poultry processing. They help companies maintain a stable workforce in an industry that has long struggled with labor shortages. And so I think the big question that a lot of employers are asking is, what happens when they lose work authorization, when they lose their legal status? What's the impact going to be on them, but also on Marylanders ourselves?
Now, again, we're talking to you a day before the 250th anniversary of the United States itself. Now, during the revolution, about 50% of the soldiers who fought were immigrants. The Pilgrims were immigrants. Many of us grew up with stories about the Statue of Liberty inviting immigrants. It says it on the tableau that the Statue of Liberty holds. It's worth asking if that story of America is fundamentally shifting or if it just looks that way. What are your thoughts?
I think this is an inflection point. I think this is a defining test of whether we are still living up to the promise at our founding. As you noted, our nation was shaped and strengthened by newcomers who were drawn by opportunity and freedom and everything that our country represented. And I think immigrants and refugees are not separate from the American story. They are central to it. And, you know, I even think about my family, you know, fleeing a civil war in Sri Lanka, coming to Baltimore, being helped by the local community that employed my dad as a Baltimore City public school teacher that gave us opportunity. And I regularly wonder whether that opportunity that was given to our family will be an opportunity given to future families. And if it's not, what does that mean? What is the cost that our country incurs? And ultimately, the story of welcome is not written by the government alone. And that's why I have hope. It is shaped every day by acts of inclusion. And at this 250th anniversary, I think it is up to all of us to decide whether that story defines America's future or if it only remains part of our past.
A good answer to a broader term of what's next, but the more immediate look at what's next, and we were speaking about Haitians and how they're being impacted by this Supreme Court ruling. There are also Syrians who are impacted by it as well. We know that parts of Syria are still unsettled. It's been upwards of a decade of the war going over there and the regime of Bashar al-Assad ending. There's refugees from other countries, El Salvador, Lebanon, Sudan, and Ukraine, who may also lose their TPS status this fall. So what is next in the immediate short-term view?
Well, I think this is going to be a question in terms of the overall impact on TPS, because as you said, there are a number of populations where their home countries are bogged down by gang violence, civil war, the collapse of everything that has allowed for any sense of safety and stability. And I think what you're seeing in terms of the administration's efforts is part of the largest de-documentation effort that we've seen. And what it means is that families who came here doing everything that we asked of them have had their legal status removed or threatened. I think it is a tragedy because I think it's at odds with what so many Americans believe, which is if you followed the right path, a legal path to come into the country, you ought to deserve protection.
Since this ruling, have there been any anecdotes that you can share, the people you've talked to in the community, be it in Maryland, be it across the country, all the people you work with? Is there any sort of anecdote in the last week since this ruling that's really stuck with you from the people you've discussed with?
I think overall, our clients are just experiencing such anxiety and disbelief. And I think that disbelief is born of the fact that they followed every step that we described as the process. And now for the rug to be pulled out from underneath them has obviously led to so much anxiety and fear. Just the other piece of this is the community's reaction. What's been incredible and unique in the response to Haitian TPS has been bipartisan congressional support. I mean, bear in mind that the Hill actually passed a bill to grant Haiti TPS, and there was a bill introduced just a couple weeks ago in the Senate. And so I think there is an opportunity for Congress to step in and right this wrong.
Krish Omara Vignaraja is president and CEO of Global Refuge. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Coming up next, we travel back 250 years to hear about the printing of the Declaration of Independence and where you can see two declarations up close here in Maryland. I'm Matt Bush, and this is WIPR's Friday News Roundup. Stay with us after this short break. And welcome back. You are listening to WIPR's News Roundup, our weekly show examining some of the big issues facing Baltimore, our region, and our state. Nearly 250 years ago, a Baltimore woman put her name on the Declaration of Independence, joining the likes of John Hancock, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As part of the WIPR News Team's occasional series, Holding the Old Line, 250 Years of Maryland History, John Lee reports that just like those founding fathers, Mary Catherine Goddard was risking everything as she made the second printing of the Declaration of Independence.
The extraordinary document, dated January 1777, is housed at one of the Johns Hopkins University Museums. While it's the second printing of the Declaration, it's the first that has the signatures of the members of the Continental Congress. And there's one other name at the bottom, the printers, Mary Catherine Goddard. Amy Kimball is the materials manager, special collections, at the Johns Hopkins University Libraries.
This was a cause she believed in, too. And I think putting her name, her full name on this, is just her making that assertion in a way.
In December of 1776, the Continental Congress was meeting in Baltimore after fleeing Philadelphia because there was a threat that the city would be taken over by the British. After General George Washington's victory at Trenton on December 26th, things started looking up. Kimball says Congress wanted a second printing of the Declaration. Unlike the first printing in July of 1776, this one would have all their names on it.
This put everybody in danger, having their names associated with this document. You know, this could have been seen as an act of treason.
Congress turned to Goddard. At the time, she was running a printing shop and newspaper on Market Street, now Baltimore Street, a few blocks from where Congress was meeting. For a previous printing job for Congress, Goddard did not use her full name. This time, she did.
In this instance, she chooses to print her entire name, her full name. She discloses who she is, just as they are disclosing who they are.
So she's taking a stand, too.
She is indeed.
She made 13 prints of the Declaration, one for each state. Nine still exist, including the one at Hopkins Evergreen Museum and Library, which also houses other Goddard artifacts, including a 1782 almanac. Margaret Burry is the associate director of Johns Hopkins Libraries.
We want to be able to share with people the really fascinating and complicated history of not only the United States, but other parts of the world. And we're here to document it and to try to promote it and to make people interested in learning more about it.
Here's part of that complicated history. Goddard later enslaved a woman, Belinda Starling. She was Goddard's heir and was freed upon her death. And there's another part of Goddard's story. She was named Baltimore's first postmaster when an American postal service was created in 1775. She was the only woman in the colonies given that commission.
There were a number of women who were engaged in postal work, just not officially holding commissions.
That's Daniel Piazza with the Smithsonian National Postal Museum. He says Goddard kept that job until 1789, the first year of Washington's presidency. Washington's postmaster general fired Goddard. He believed the job of postmaster was too demanding for a woman.
Mary Catherine does not go quietly. There's a petition that's signed by 200 Baltimoreans wanting her reappointed as postmaster. She takes her case to President Washington. She takes her case to the United States Senate.
To no avail, she lost the postmaster's gig, And at this point, she's no longer a printer either because she had a falling out with her brother who took the business. So until about 1810, Mary Catherine Goddard ran a shop selling books and almanacs. She died in 1816 and is buried in the Old St. Paul Cemetery. John Lee, WIPR News.
Martina Cotto is the Vice President of Research and Library Director at the Maryland Center for History and Culture, where they have just opened their own exhibits. One is on Goddard and the other on the role of some other Marylanders in the Declaration of Independence. Martina joins us in studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So from what we hear, you're also a Mary Catherine Goddard fan.
Well, how can you not be? If you learn a little bit about her, you have to become a Mary Catherine Goddard fan with such a storied life that she's led.
Now, we just heard from our reporter, John Lee, but a little bit about the exhibit on Goddard that you opened up just this past Thursday. I understand it goes far beyond Goddard's role in printing the Declaration of Independence. You describe her as a postmaster, publisher, printer, and revolutionary. Tell us about that.
That is absolutely correct. So as a lot of people have heard lately, Mary Catherine Goddard is definitely having her moment in history after a very long time, and deservedly so. And the beauty of our collection at the Maryland Center for History and Culture is that we are actually able to cover the years that she spent in Baltimore, which was pretty much the latter half of her life.
Now, we're building her fan base here right now, but she had plenty of detractors, too.
She did. So Mary Catherine Goddard was Baltimore's first woman postmaster, and quite likely United States' first woman postmaster. Her father had been postmaster in New London, Connecticut, which is where she was born. Her brother William played a huge role in the establishment of what we know as the United States Postal Service today. So with that context, she was appointed as Baltimore's first woman postmaster in 1775 and performed that role quite well for about 15 years. When she was quietly dismissed, she was obviously upset because she put in a lot of effort into this position. For example, she funded postal riders during the Revolutionary War herself when the money ran out, and she felt quite patriotic in this responsibility of hers. So when she was dismissed, she clearly didn't like it. And what happened is she wrote two petitions herself. One was to the United States Senate, and the other one was to President George Washington. And then in addition to that, the citizens of Baltimore, about 235 of them, submitted a petition of their own to the then Postmaster General, John Osgood. None of the petitions were successful. However, the very petition, which we have a reproduction of in the exhibition, proves how popular she was and how appreciated she was by her fellow citizens in Baltimore.
Now, not just a postmaster, you talk about Goddard also as a documentarian and a revolutionary, and maybe in the scope of the Revolutionary War, people might think more of military things or intelligence things. But what role do documents play in overthrowing one government and installing another?
For the Goddard family themselves, I mentioned that it's a family business with them. They actually had a history of speaking up against the trespasses of the British government. They lived in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and then finally Baltimore, Maryland. And they printed quite unabashedly. And not a lot of major battles happen on Maryland soil. So there are Maryland fighters, troops, fighting elsewhere, such as the Battle of Brooklyn. And a lot of our listeners might be familiar with the story of how Maryland got its nickname of the Old Line State.
And if they're not, stay tuned for the next segment of the show. They will learn more about that.
Oh, perfect. So they fought elsewhere. However, Maryland just tries to, you know, keep up with regular life. People still have to go get up in the morning and tend to their farms and harvest and go to school. In fact, one of the objects that is on display in this exhibition is a playbill for a theater play. King Richard III, no less, because people were still trying to, you know, have a semblance of a normal life during this time. So documents play a huge role in that, you know, the Declaration of Independence itself is a document, and it was spread by being printed as a broadside, by being printed in newspapers, by being read out loud in communities. You know, literacy levels were varying across the country. Not everybody had the privilege to read it for themselves.
What other documents do you have on display right now? Well, there are exhibitions, including this playbill of Richard III.
Exactly. So I am completely enamored with her almanacs. Quite common in the 18th century, they were books that helped people watch the stars, watch the phases of the moon, plan for agricultural phases of their year. But she also added poetic elements. And she also asks for subscriptions, either monetary or people can submit old rags, which is interesting because rags were instrumental in papermaking during this time. Mm. Your old clothes, your old cloths could be repurposed, turned into a pulp, and then end up as maybe the next Declaration of Independence.
That's fascinating. So the men who signed their names on the Declaration of Independence, you know, who were they?
If we're talking about Maryland, then mm-hmm. we're talking about four signers, Charles Carroll of Carrollton, Peca, Chase, and Stone. There were four. They clearly came from landowning classes. Charles Carroll of Carrollton, for example, was arguably the richest man in the United States when he died in 1832, owning between 300 and 400 individuals at least. And I call them the Boys Club. The main pieces on display are actually four chairs. They used to belong to each of the four signers. So you can imagine the symbolism in, you know, a person of this national significance sitting in a chair, working at their desk, maybe poring over a version of the Declaration or other important documents, and then signing it. We also introduced one other Declaration of Independence. So we have two copies of the Declaration of Independence across the hall from each other, kind of looking at each other and talking to each other. And the second one, as opposed to Mary Catherine Goddard's, which she published in January 1777, very interestingly, while the Continental Congress is meeting in Baltimore. And we have spent so much time poring over the way she describes her name and signs her name in many documents. And she spells it with a K, with a C, with an A, with an E. But in the Declaration of Independence, she places her full name. It says, printed in Baltimore by Mary Catherine Goddard. And then in the other exhibition, there's a really famous copy called the Stone Declaration, which was commissioned as a commemorative piece. So in 1820, this is decades after the Revolutionary War, the fledgling United States, you know, has also been through the War of 1812. And John Quincy Adams notes that the revolutionary generation are kind of dying off. So all the original signers are almost gone, save for John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Charles Carroll of Carrollton. So, you know, the Maryland representative, who is also the only Catholic signer and the last surviving signer, they're the only ones around. So what is commissioned is this quote-unquote Stone Declaration. So it looks like it's handwritten, but it's actually a copper plate on parchment, which is animal skin. So it's a completely different type of material and print from the Goddard Declaration, and it's really interesting to see them almost side by side, but definitely across the hall talking to each other. So we can already see how people were looking toward celebrating the first 50 years of the Declaration.
A lot of the focus here is on material goods. Why is it important to hear what the material goods are telling us about the history of the time?
They're telling us that it's a really complex history. And this is something that I say quite a lot. I've found in my work, maybe I'm a little biased because of the audiences that we work with, but I've found that Marylanders tend to be quite knowledgeable about their history and quite knowledgeable about the contradictions within their history. So I believe that this year has been the year of exploring those contradictions and learning how to sit with them and how to accept all of them at the same time so that we can become better citizens in the future. So as an example of this, Mary Catherine Goddard, lest we be too celebratory, which we should also note that she, at the end of her life, left her possessions and whatever was left after her death to the young woman that she enslaved. This woman's name was Belinda Starling. And we should also note that she didn't have that rich of a life toward the end. There's a lot of complexity there, you know, for how a person can be so rich and yet not so rich and yet an enslaver, and yet give somebody their freedom at their death.
What's the reaction been to it so far?
It is so fresh. We are still waiting for reactions. So we're very keen for folks to come and visit. Please let us know how we did, and please let us know how you feel about it. And the exhibition will be on until January 2027, because we want to commemorate that January of 1777 when it was actually printed.
So how can people come see it?
We are open from Wednesday to Sunday to the public. 10 to 5 are our hours. The exhibition is on whenever we are open. We will be closed on July 4th, but please come to see us Sunday after that. And then, like I said, we have time until January.
Rutina Cotto is the Vice President of Research and Library Director at the Maryland Center for History and Culture. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to hear about the Battle of Brooklyn and Maryland's role in it up next here on the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. Stay with us after this short break. Welcome back to WIPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, News Director of the award-winning WIPR Newsroom. And this week, as we head into the 250th year of the United States, we're looking back at Maryland's role in starting the nation. And we're going to head to Brooklyn, New York, not the one here in Baltimore, because we're talking about the Battle of Brooklyn in New York, fought by Marylanders. Confused? Well, we have a Baltimorean professor in Queens, also in New York, Tom Moore. He's an associate professor of journalism at the City University of New York, and he's here with us to explain all that. Tom, thanks for coming on the News Roundup.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
This keeps coming up. The Battle of Brooklyn is the first major battle of the Revolution, and it was the largest one. But what role did Maryland have to do with that?
Maryland's role, indeed. We have this little-known battle, but it was the first one of the war, only a few weeks, barely a month after the Declaration of Independence. Yes, as you said, up in New York, in Brooklyn, and this elite fighting force called the Maryland 400 traveled up to New York. These soldiers fought in the battle, and they helped save Washington's army, vastly outnumbered by the British. And they were up in New York to try to hold off the British for as long as possible. I think if you could read Washington's mind, he knew he couldn't beat these British forces. They were vastly outnumbered. And I talked about what this Maryland 400, this elite force, was doing up in Brooklyn with Revolutionary War expert Kim Mayer.
And this is Kim Mayer right here, giving a very dramatic description of that battle.
256 soldiers were killed or missing that day because they really took on what was essentially a suicide mission. The British were raining fire down upon them, and they were tasked with keeping an escape route open so that the Pennsylvania riflemen and the Delaware soldiers and the Connecticut soldiers could get across to the inner line. And it's really to Maryland that we owe the fact that the American army was not completely vanquished at the outset of the Revolutionary War.
So who was there in that fight, Tom?
We had a lot of people from all over the state, but Annapolis was very active and very well populated. Then so was Baltimore. So draw a line from there over to the Eastern Shore and down to Annapolis. And they were from basically the areas of Maryland that were the most populated in the colonial era.
And those would have been areas around the Chesapeake Bay. You also spoke with Emily Olin Squires at the Maryland State Archives. She's also been trying to track down each of these fighters, along with everyone else who was there with them.
The camp followers as well, the women, the enslaved people, indentured servants, you know, everybody played a role. Everyday people, by doing their everyday jobs, made a difference.
So there's more to the story. It's not just the story of George Washington and his fellow Linden gentry.
That's right. Not just the officers, but the regular lower-ranking soldiers. And she says that the archives, the study, the research went a lot deeper.
It is, yes, the leaders and the officers and the generals, they're all important, but we've known about them for a while. These individuals we haven't known about, and to have them be recognized really is what it's all about to me.
She went into more detail and talked about who exactly was out there. Aside from Washington's troops, there's a research project at the Maryland State Archives in Annapolis called Finding the Maryland 400. It's also the title of a book coming out shortly, done by Owen Lurie, who's also with the Maryland State Archives. Owen Lurie went into more detail.
The best numbers we have, there were about 3.5% of the Maryland line was black in 1778, which is the only year we have numbers for. Many of those people were free blacks. So there was would have been probably a small number of enslaved soldiers or people who had been enslaved who were now in the army. But for the most part, it was free blacks. And so this is a way to recognize their role and the larger role of African Americans in the war effort during the Revolution.
You had free blacks, you had enslaved people of African descent, you had a mix.
Now, it's worth remembering those fighting on behalf of the colonies were fighting against the British, who also had black forces among them. What was the enticement to fight on the British side?
Well, the British did have a deal. They had an offer. They said that if an enslaved person from a rebel family with sympathies to the Declaration of Independence and the free colonists and saying goodbye to Britain, a rebel farm owner, slave owner, if you left that farm, if you left that owner, then you would fight for the British and be freed at the end of the war. And with a lot of bureaucracy at the end of the war, they did review the lists of the enslaved that left the rebel or Continental Army supporting landowners. And those enslaved people who went to fight for the British were freed. A lot of them were taken up to Nova Scotia, for example.
Now, it's taken almost 250 years for this history to be examined like this. This is also a major part of the 1619 Project. How does this new awareness change how we see the Declaration of Independence being signed 250 years ago?
I think the headline there would be it was a lot more diverse than you think. Now, George Washington's forces did not have the same number of people of African descent fighting on the side of the Continental Army. The British had more because of that offer that the British made for freedom. But I think it's interesting to throw that diversity into public awareness, especially when we talk about Black patriots. One very famous one, Thomas Kearny, and bringing people like him into the public awareness. He enlisted as a private, and what was really rare was he was promoted to corporal. People of African descent were promoted to sergeant, but Kearny made corporal, and that was pretty rare. Kearny, in one act of heroism, picked up a wounded major general, also a Marylander, picked him up, carried him off the battlefield later in the war, and helped save the officer's life. And Kearny, as a Marylander, also died on the Eastern Shore in the Denton area. James Robinson's story is pretty remarkable. He's born into slavery on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. It's not clear exactly where. The records aren't clear in his overall story, but some reports do say that he not only fought in the American Revolution, he fought against the British again in the War of 1812 under the command of Andrew Jackson. After the Revolutionary War, he was enslaved again instead of being freed after his service in the Revolution. Later, he lived as a free man. And the details of Robinson's life are not 100% confirmed. A lot of that happens in this era. And in the bigger picture, the British promised slaves freedom, as we discussed, if they joined their side during the Revolutionary War, while the Continental Army, Washington's forces, did not have a plan to free slaves who fought for the rebel side.
You and these historians you've spoken with are not the only ones thinking about diversity in the American Revolution. WYPR has a podcast, Maryland Unfolded, on their role. Make sure you have a listen of that. And plans are also coming together in Annapolis to commemorate the diversity of that era, erecting a statue honoring Maryland's Black patriots of the Revolutionary War. What can you tell us about those plans and those people?
Well, as Owen Lurie at the Maryland State Archives said, it's going to happen in August, a little closer to the 250th anniversary of the Battle of Brooklyn.
So the Black Patriots Monument is designed to speak to something that has been missing from the story of the Maryland line, I think of the Continental Army in general. They fought in integrated units, so alongside white soldiers doing on the front lines, doing regular infantry work. It's the last time that the U.S. has an integrated army until 1948.
Owen said that this monument is important because it helps kind of put a marker on how many Black patriots were actually there. And one detail about this is that it's being placed near the spot where a statue of Roger Taney was. That was taken down years ago. And of course, Taney is known for the Dred Scott case, which ruled that Blacks were not U.S. citizens.
That statue will be on one side of the Maryland State House, and the other side is Lawyers Mall, which honors Thurgood Marshall, the first Black U.S. Supreme Court justice in the United States. Tom Moore is an independent journalist and a professor at City University, New York in Queens, and he's also a native Baltimorean. Thank you so much for coming on our show, Tom.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
WYPR has a recent episode out about Black patriots and loyalists in the American Revolution on our podcast, Maryland Unfolded. You can check that out on WYPR.org or wherever you get podcasts. Coming up on WYPR this weekend, we have more 4th of July specials for you. The Making of Us is airing Sunday, July 5th at 6 p.m. It takes a deep dive into some of the things that make America, America. The War of Independence, the Constitution, and representative democracy. And tomorrow on the 4th at 6 p.m., as you prepare for fireworks, we have an encore presentation of Patriarchs, a six-part audio drama of the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams based on their own letters and documents. Stay with us for a sneak peek after this break. You're listening to the WYPR News Roundup. Welcome back to WYPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. This weekend marked the 4th and the 250th anniversary of the United States. We'll be airing a three-hour, six-part historical drama revealing the lives, politics, and relationships of the country's patriarchs. Patriarchs is its title. And tomorrow on the 4th, as part of our programming, we're airing it from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m.
And it seemed to me we should meet on a personal basis. We have much in common.
Patriarchs pivots on the stories of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams.
What would I have in common with a Boston lawyer?
Yes. I'm Harvard, you're William and Mary, but see here. We are both farmers, we're both lawyers, and we both serve the Continental Congress.
The former president's friendship formed while debating political ideals, along with the language of the Declaration of Independence, which they both contributed to and signed. The story and conversations are based on letters and historical documents.
Well, as I see it, there are only two simple forms of functional government. Do you agree? One, a monarchy, the rule of one, in which all power, and perhaps religion too, is entrusted to the discretion of a single person. Two, an aristocracy, the rule of the few, in which the power is given to a few great, rich, wise men.
But there was a third.
Is there?
In a democracy, there is first that most splendid of virtues, equality before the law.
Herodotus. There, you see? Something else we have in common. We're both classicists.
Democracy is the only form of government that allows or even encourages human freedom.
And how would you define freedom?
The opportunity of each man to do what is right in his own eyes.
Yeah. Anarchy, then.
The moral authority of government exists only in proportion to its ability to embody the will of the people and execute it. Did you really mean to leave that third form off your list?
I did it only to goad you into speaking up for your beliefs. You say nothing.
Well, nobody can get a word in. You don't stop talking long enough.
But political ideals often confront a less idealistic reality.
I was particularly moved by the section that was sadly omitted, in which you referred to Negro slavery as cruel war against human nature itself. That's so eloquent. It surprised me, you being one of the biggest slaveholders in Virginia.
Of which I'm not proud. I consider slavery to be a grave sin, and myself to be the principal sinner.
In politics, 2.5 centuries ago, also get personal.
Perhaps the Federalist Press might find some interest in what I have on you, sir. I believe Sally Hemings is the young woman's name.
What about Sally?
As you may know, sir, I have no compunction about reporting the gossip as fact. But I believe we both know it is actual fact.
What is?
That our great and grand president has for many years enjoyed carnal knowledge of one of his black slaves.
You can listen to the full 3 hours of Patriarchs, the historical drama, tomorrow on the 4th at 6 p.m. here on WYPR 88.1. Next up, as the United States celebrates its 250th anniversary, Baltimore's Cherry Hill celebrates 100 years of black history, 80 years of Cherry Hill, and 10 years of the Cherry Hill Festival. That's complete with a drone show. We're going to have that next year on the WYPR News Roundup. Stay with us after a short break. Welcome back to the WYPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. As you start plotting your firework plans this weekend, have you considered a drone show? A Along with the Inner Harbor fireworks tomorrow night, drones will unite along the water in Cherry Hill. This year also marks a decade of the Cherry Hill Festival and a century of formerly recognized Black history. Black History Month got its start as Black History Week 100 years ago, and 80 years ago, Cherry Hill was welcoming some of its first residents as the nation's first, largest, and maybe only planned suburban community for African Americans. To talk about what's planned for this year's festival and how the neighborhood will be commemorating all these events, Fanon Hill is joining us by Zoom. Fanon is a musician, producer, filmmaker, and co-founder of the Youth Resiliency Institute that puts on the Cherry Hill Festival. Welcome to the show, Fanon.
Thank you so much. Wonderful being here.
So tell us, what are the plans tomorrow night to celebrate all these things in Cherry Hill that we were just discussing?
So this year marks a very rare convergence of historic anniversaries. This year is the 10th anniversary of the Cherry Hill Arts and Music Waterfront Festival. It's obviously the 250th anniversary of the United States of America, but it is also the 100th anniversary of the movement that led to Black History Month, and the 80th anniversary of Cherry Hill Homes Public Housing. And so we are commemorating four historic milestones and elevating diverse voices and the creative expressions that we see as forming our collective identity.
And there are a number of events planned for this festival this weekend, and it is Rain or Shine. Your headliners are both reggae bands, but you also have gospel, R&B, Afro jazz, hip-hop, and Baltimore club music playing. Quite the musical selection for everyone, right?
That's correct. We like to introduce local artists from Cherry Hill and Greater South Baltimore and provide them with opportunities to perform on our stage with artists such as the legendary Grammy-winning reggae artist Michael Rose, who will be performing with Subatomic Dub System this year. And so we love to be able to share about the importance of arts and culture, but also it's very important per introducing young artists and community members to diverse musical art forms.
Now, it's more than just the music. It's more than just the party. You were talking about how Cherry Hill was a planned Black community. 80 years that you're celebrating this year, the anniversary of that. Tell us about what it means that it was a planned Black community post-World War II America. What does that mean now, 80 years later?
Right. Great question. A historian by the name of Jack Brehan once shared that because Cherry Hill was a new neighborhood, residents literally had to create institutions from scratch. So just about every Cherry Hill club, recreation team, church congregation was established by Cherry Hill's African-American residents. And the Youth Resiliency Institute, we celebrate the pioneering spirit of those early Black residents in everything we do. This year at the festival, we are going to have an exhibition, Cherry Hill Charm, which chronicles the self-determination and charm of Cherry Hill's pioneer Black residents. So we were able to partner with the Afro Archives, and this exhibit tells the story of Cherry Hill's residents and their struggle against segregation as well as environmental racism. So recognizing that it's been 10 years since the festival's inception, we remember a time when many people claimed that a festival in Cherry Hill would never succeed. Today, however, thousands now gather in Cherry Hill, and the Cherry Hill Arts and Music Waterfront Festival has in many ways become a cornerstone. We stand up for the legacy of those pioneering Black residents and draw from their values and courage.
What can you tell us, or what would you like people to know about Cherry Hill coming to the festival this weekend who may not be familiar with it? Obviously, you just went through a lot of history. A lot of very famous Baltimoreans were there. What do you want people to know about Cherry Hill this weekend as they come to the festival?
What I would love for people to know about Cherry Hill is the pioneering self-determination that those early Black residents demonstrated. It still exists in Cherry Hill. There are amazing residents of all ages who are on the front line of transformation in Cherry Hill. I think about Devin, who recently graduated from high school in Baltimore City. He's been a young man who's been part of the Cherry Hill Arts and Music Waterfront Festival team since he was in elementary school. And he made it very clear that he wanted a career in public service. And he will be soon entering into the Baltimore City Police Academy. Every year, Devin, as many of those pioneering Black residents in Cherry Hill, they made sure that they connected through collective work and responsibility to resources. So we make sure as an organization that that continues to happen to this day.
And there is this drone show. This is the second year you've done a drone show at the festival. Going to step it up from last year? Tell us about it.
Ah, you're going to have to come and see with your own eyes. But yes, we are so, so thankful for the Mayor's Office of Arts, Culture, and Entertainment. They partnered with us on the drone show. And one thing that's very unique about drone shows is drone shows are an environmentally friendly alternative to fireworks. And they reduce noise pollution. And they're much more gentle to individuals who may be suffering from the impact of gun violence. They're much more gentle to the wildlife in Middle Branch Park. In the past, there were many festival attendees who left before the fireworks show because the noise just was traumatic for them in terms of them having to relive episodes where they witnessed violence. So we always factor those conversations in everything we do with the festival. So it's been quite a remarkable journey in terms of making that transition from the fireworks show to the drone show.
Anand Hill is the co-founder of the Youth Resiliency Institute, which is sponsoring this weekend's Cherry Hill Arts and Music Waterfront Festival. It's tomorrow, July 4th at Middle Branch Park. Anand, have fun this weekend. Stay cool, stay hydrated. Good advice for everybody, but thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
You're listening to Patapsco River Love, performed and produced by Navasha Dea, DJ Mighty Mark, and yours truly, Fanon Hill. I want to add a recent update that due to the forecast of extreme heat, the Baltimore City Office of Emergency Management, in consultation with the Mayor's Office of Arts, Culture, and Entertainment, has requested a delayed festival start time to avoid the hottest part of the day. So the Cherry Hill Arts and Music Waterfront Festival is now scheduled to start at 5 p.m., and we have events scheduled through 10 p.m. Blessings of the water flow.
Don't you know, protect us. And that's it for this week's WIPR News Roundup. Next week, we're going to look at the election results in Baltimore County as they are finally certified. I'm Matt Bush, the news director at WIPR. Isaac Moss, Elizabeth Nonemaker, and Mallory Pinkard-Pierre helped us with production today. Shania Mapson and Sean Murphy are our studio engineers. And Amy Walters is WIPR's executive producer. Thank you so much for listening. Happy 4th.
Welcome to the Patapsco. Welcome to the...